Welcome back to Lost in Citations. Today's guest is Dr. Curtis Kelly from Kansai University. Reporting live from Portland, Oregon, Dr. Kelly, welcome back to Lost in Citations.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm from Kansai University, but I'm now a professor emeritus, I guess you call it, somebody who's retired.
Oh, well, you're the second professor emeritus from Kansai University that I've spoken to this week.
Oh, really? Who else?
Can you guess the second?
Fred Anderson, it must
That's
be. One
correct.
of the
That's
smartest guys
correct.
in Japan. Oh, excellent.
Yeah, I spoke to him on Tuesday
Uh-huh.
and we discussed one of the chapters in the book that you also published a chapter in, Teaching
Yeah.
English at Japanese Universities.
Yeah, the classic.
And it was a thrill talking to him. And it was funny because I was telling him the process that I kind of go through with this podcast. So I tell guests, look, just say whatever you want. And so don't worry about it. And then I'll send you the MP3. And if you want to take something out, then we can take it out later. So just kind of go for it. So that way people don't sort of hesitate and try to think of the perfect thing to say. They just go for it, right? And that tends to work. And Fred was saying, well, before I recorded this podcast with you, I was listening to the episode with Curtis Kelly. It was very, very polished. Very, very polished. And I said, and actually, I had forgotten this whole thing until like just before we started recording. And I told him, I said, oh, well, and I just repeated what I just said to you. I said, oh, don't worry. I think I can't remember exactly, but I send the MP3 to guests and they have a listen. So he might have taken some stuff out. I don't remember. But then I remember you're the guy who said he doesn't listen to the podcasts. You said anything's fine, Jonathan, because I'll never listen to this. That was you, right?
Right, but keep in mind, I listen to the other podcasts. I just don't want to hear my voice. I get really embarrassed.
Well, then you should take that as a compliment because he thought your podcast was extremely polished.
Well, great. Thank you. Yeah, very
That was
glad
the
to hear
first.
it.
I think he listened to the first one. So you've come on twice. The first one was Citation 9, and then you came again. So Citation 9, you talked about a paper you wrote in the 90s about projecting the trends in the Japanese university education system. He came back on Citation 73 to discuss one of your think tank articles. And then fortunately for everyone, you've come back again to return to another one of your think tank articles. So
Yes, I'm
this
trying to
is a
keep
thrill.
my mental deterioration, on file.
I'm still in disbelief that you're not in Japan. It just doesn't really make sense to me. It's weird because I'm staring at two books that you actually sent me. One is Stephen W. Sears, his book on Chancellorsville, and the other is The Final Fortress, The Campaign for Vicksburg, 1862 to 1863. We had a discussion once, and I told you that I like the Civil War, American Civil War history, and you had sent me an email a while back. You said, "Look, I'm leaving Japan, so if you'd like some of these books, I'll just give me your address." And even then, it didn't sink. You said, "Well, I'm doing a kind of a recon mission to Portland, seeing what the schools are like." I was like, "Okay, didn't really sink, but I guess you really did move to Portland, and I guess you're really not in Japan anymore." So,
Yeah, and I miss it. Can I get my books back if I come back to Japan?
absolutely.
I'm kidding, of course, but
How
yeah.
many did you? How many did you send? Were you able to send them all out?
I sent out about 20 to people, but then, some of these books are kind of rare, these Civil War libraries. So I gave it to a guy that runs a little shop in Kyoto that just loves books. Just glad to take, he actually gave me some money for them.
Nice.
Just glad to take them.
Well, maybe off air, tell me the name of the shop and I'll go buy them all back if you come back.
Really, it's cathartic to move from one country to another because you have to throw everything away. Collected over 40 years or whatever. Not everything, but almost everything.
Was that cathartic or traumatic?
Both. But I think in a good way. I
How
think it's the
so?
kind of thing you should do once in a while to sort of lighten the not so important load.
Well, yeah, how much could you actually bring with you?
But we ship 20 boxes.
Okay.
They're basically about a foot and a half, 2 feet by 2 feet boxes. That's how much we could fit into this deal we made with the company. So there's enough to fit all of them into my car.
Wow.
That's for four people.
How long have you been in Portland now?
About a year and a half.
How's it going? Fill us in.
Well,
I'm sure people that you're widely known. I don't know how well you've been keeping in touch with everyone, but I'm sure there's people that haven't heard from you in a while. So catch people up who haven't talked to you in a while.
here I'm just kind of a weird guy, weird old guy that's just sort of hanging around, but I suffered re-entry shock in a way I never expected.
How
I mean, I
so?
know America. I've lived in America. I grew up in America. I've been back every year. But I did encounter this kind of re-entry shock, this one thing. I have to drive everywhere every day. I mean, I take my wife to work, then take my kids to school, then I take them to their club, pick them up after school, then I pick her up after work, then drive them to their clubs here and there, and sometimes tournaments in another state. So I average about 3 hours a day in a car.
Wow.
I mean, that's like driving to Seattle every day from Portland to Seattle or something. So it's kind of,
How do you pass
not.
the time? Are you doing something productive?
Oh, I listen to audiobooks while I'm driving or news or whatever. I was listening again today to Baron Cohen talk about his research on empathy versus inventiveness,
Oh,
which
great.
were,
Oh, yeah, I was reading about that in the article. So we should sort of start this correctly. The paper we're going to be just, thank you. The guest is more professional than the host. The article we're going to be discussing today is was published in the Mindbrain Education SIG, which you started, and it's published in their SIG publication, The Think Tank, and the article was published in a special issue about testing. I think it was November of 2022. The link for the think tanks and this article will be on your show notes, which with other app, which whatever app you're listening to. And the article's name is Lawyers and Priestesses in the World of Tests. And I thoroughly enjoyed this paper. Actually, so you and Fred, these are the first interviews I've recorded in about a year because I've been doing my PhD, so I really only want to focus on my own thing, right? So
Yes.
now Fred's paper really fit into my PhD. I was really excited to talk to you, so I kind of made an exception for you. I said, okay, well, this paper isn't really in the focus of my PhD, but I gotta say, it was really nice. I don't know, it's towards the end of the week. I've been doing a lot of reading and researching. It was kind of burned out. It was nice to kind of read something that wasn't in necessarily my PhD, finger quotes, laser focus. I really enjoyed this. I really enjoyed this paper a lot. All your writing, I really enjoy. So it was nice. I don't know if you found that when you were doing your PhD, you kind of need to be disciplined and not get, taken too off track, right? But every now and again, it's
Yeah.
kind of nice to dip your toes in other. Oh, this is nice.
Well, I believe we have to be generalists, that we, most of education is oriented towards, I mean, a higher level of education is to making somebody study this really deep, narrow field. So they're like the world expert, or at least the city expert in one particular topic. But we need people that are kind of generalists too, that sort of connect things and carry things from one place to another. And that's what I consider myself. I want to tell everybody too. The article I wrote is not highly researched. It's not my specialty. Most of the articles I write, it's taking somebody else's research and trying to apply it or connect it to our world in the language classroom. So this is not like a journal article. I've written journal articles, but this is not like that. It's something that I think is in some ways just as important. Rather than pushing just the research forward, but taking what research exists and giving it to everybody in a way they can use it in class. So it's not as rigorous as most of your interviewees, the things that most of your interviewees write.
Well, I don't know. I feel like that's kind of one of the core reasons I started this podcast because I was struggling with, academic reading and academic research, like a lot of people do. And I was actually talking with Fred. I was just saying, like, I started this podcast 2020. I still feel writing is just as difficult as it was back then. I feel like I have more social support possibly, and I'm more empathy from other people that everyone finds it difficult in their own ways. But I always think sometimes when I'm reading these papers, some of these papers that are feels like a very convoluted language, and it's hard for them to get their message across. I always think it's like, why does it have to be like this? So I kind of feel like things like this are really, really important. I mean, was that one of the reasons why you started the think tank? It was like, hey, let's try to translate some of these concepts where teachers can use it in the classroom, especially teachers who aren't necessarily wanting to sit for, 48 hours and read through all of the research that's written in a really
Well,
dry
nobody
way.
can, even neuroscientists can't read through everything in the field. And this has been well recognized. So Harvard started this mind, brain, and education program that was connecting psychology, neuroscience, and education. So that's where the term mind, brain, education comes from. So it's not a lot of schools have recognized that, but some people have. There's lots of research that shows that information discovered in neuroscience going into education is just, there's not a very good transfer. Neuroscientists can't write for educators, and educators can't read neuroscience in general. So you and I are kind of doing the same thing. We're taking what's really hard and finding a way to make it digestible and meaningful to the people who really need it, which is not just the people listening, but their students.
Yeah, I kind of liked your bio at the bottom of the paper we're discussing today, where you kind of adapted your bio to the theme of the paper, which I thought was kind of cool. I never noticed that before. Do you do that for all the think tanks? Do you kind of like change it a
Even
bit?
after Ryan started doing that, so I did too.
Oh,
I
really?
started.
Okay.
But this bio, I'm looking at the bio of this particular article. Yeah. He's confused as to whether he's an empathizer, since his life mission is to relieve the suffering of the classroom, or a systemizer who loves inventing stuff and playing computer games. That's right. That's my bio there.
I
Part of the
like that, and
bio.
I've seen that before, your life mission to relieve the suffering of the classroom. And that's not just the suffering for students, right? That's the suffering for teachers as well, I'm guessing.
Yeah, but I think mainly of students, because I've just seen some really sad things in English classes with students that lose their self-esteem and just feel bad about themselves and feel they're stupid because we don't teach it very well. I mean, we teach it the best that the field tells us how to do it, but it's not the kind of thing that's easy to teach or easy to learn in a non-English speaking country.
Yeah, I feel like you not being here is like a huge loss to the
Oh,
industry.
really? Thank you. I feel like so useless here.
Real, that's yeah, I hate to, I don't know, I was thinking about this before we recorded. And I didn't really know how to say it, so I just kind of wrote it down. Oh, sidebar to that. Whenever I read your writing, I always get the impression that you sit down and you're writing this by hand. I don't have this image in my mind. You're sitting at the desk with like a pen or a pencil and you're writing by hand. Do you do that? Or did I just like envision that for some strange reason?
I do not,
Okay.
because things that I write by hand, if I see it a day later, I can't figure out what I wrote.
That's me too. But I guess that's a long about way to compliment you, that your writing seems very thoughtful to me. So I feel like
I
you're.
do work really hard on making something readable and interesting, trying little techniques like going down one road that really leads to a dead end. Just things that keep, and simple. So I do work on the style a lot. I want to really get good at that.
I kind of wish
Like,
this style that you're writing was more of the academic style. I one of the reasons, again, one of the reasons I started this podcast is to try to connect with people where, where you're not just reading an academic's writing, the dry ink on a page. You're trying to make the person's voice come alive, the research come alive, right? And I thought over time it would help me read academic papers better And it really hasn't. It's just made me more frustrated. Why does it have to be this way, right? Like you kind of said like, oh, well, this isn't the rigorous kind of thing. I didn't find that at all. I found there it's just a it was just a different style that's more approachable, less kind of, okay, I got to punch in my clock and read this paper now, kind of thing. So I don't know. I'm not going to change the world. I mean, academic writing is not going to change, obviously. But I get that feeling every time. Sometimes when I read papers, and sometimes when I go to people's presentations, and I think, why does it have to be this way? Who said?
It's goes back from a long time when it was believed that any research paper is like adding a brick to the temple of knowledge. As everything's kind of fixed, the pre-Kuhnian kind of thinking. But yeah, research papers are just so hard to read, and is it to impress your peers? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. One of the things oh yeah, I remember what I was going to say. Oh, one of the things I wrote down, 'cause going back to the topic of you're missed in Japan, what did I write down? Okay, I'm not a good person, but I know those who are. You're a good person. You're genuinely a good person. So I
What?
personally, I'm not a good person, but I'm able to like identify those who are. So it's a big loss that you're not in Japan. I think a lot of your presence is probably missed by many, many, many people. And not just your students, like your colleagues and the SIG
Well, thank
members
you.
and
But I think if the camera was on right now, if this was a video recording, you'd see all these question marks floating out of my head. But thank you.
all right, we'll get back to your life in Portland in a second, but let's jump into the paper. Okay, so lawyers and priestesses in the world of tests. And you start the paper with an anecdote, your student Junko, who you said, I perceived her as an archetypal A student, right? And so, and then it just turned out that she just wasn't really good at tests. And then you started talking about how you observed a play from one of your colleagues, and then some of the students that you kind of thought, oh, well, they're not archetypal A students, but they were really doing a good job on the play. And then that kind of got you thinking about different things. Now, this type of style I really like as far as starting a paper with anecdotes. Now, you see this a lot of times in books, right? I was just reading Meyer's 2014 book, The Culture Map. And every chapter is just chock full of anecdotes, which are great. And I guess you can do that in ethnological research, right? Deeper in your like PhD thesis. But they don't show up so much in like, again, they don't show a lot in articles. But for me, again, if we're talking about connecting the mind, the brain to the classroom, right? We're stories, right? That's how we latch on. So like it was nice that you started this paper with anecdotes, clear anecdotes, connecting to your line of thinking.
Yeah, well, our brain is built for stories. It's there's various reasons why the way that stories is really the brain's language of learning, and all learning was through stories until 1100 years ago. So stories just get people interested. It's something they can identify with. Our brains are metaphorical, so whatever's happening in the story is really happening to me as I read it. So, yeah, stories are powerful. I
All
got
right.
another paper.
Oh, go ahead.
The neuroscience of storytelling is stories, storytelling. But
Yeah,
that's another.
the think tank is chock full of good stuff.
No, thank you. Yeah.
I recommend people checking out again, the link will be on the show notes so people can go back.
But
And
getting back to what you're talking about, haven't you seen students that are really smart, but when it comes to test time, they just really flop around. They forget the details. They seem like a really smart people or really adult or something. Or students who have this great emotion, great social ability, but their scores at school are kind of low.
Well, especially in the language classroom, right? So
Yes.
you have some. I can envision like both sides, right? I know students who are good at tests and they're just but they're not really great at communicating,
Yeah.
right? And then I have students who are just great at communicating and they just don't care about the test at all. Maybe they don't perceive it's worth their time, or they'll do enough to get a good grade. They're not really worried about it. And then as a teacher, I'm almost thinking, well, okay, well, we have to set these parameters. And you talk about this in the paper, right? So we have to, we have to set these parameters that are leaning more towards objective than subjective, just to be fair. But then as a teacher, I'm like, well, which student shouldn't you be graded higher marks for how well you're communicating? Isn't that the point of my job here? So I struggle with that, the topic as well, as far as, what you assess to what the goal of the actual class is.
It's just that our educational system is sort of set towards one type of learner and one kind of type of learning. But the, now we just know there's so many different types of brains out there that this kind of single one pattern loop of the classroom of we pass on this information, then we test it. We pass on this information, we test all the details. It doesn't fit a lot of brains. And that's basically what I was trying to write about. And I think, remember about 20 years ago, there was this right brain people, left brain people. Right brain people are really good at details and symbols. And sorry, left brain people are. And right brain people are more artistic, more empathetic. They're into dance and social things. Then it was found that that's completely wrong. There is no right brain, left brain people at all. We're using both our hemispheres all the time. But that's because there were some discoveries that the left brain does more of the symbolic processing, and the right brain does more kind of global things. In the early days, we had that sort of view, which wasn't really correct either, but we came into this idea of right brain, left brain people. And it's because before that, we did notice there are two kinds of peoples. There's the engineers that can hardly talk to anybody, but they're really good with numbers and details. People like Bill Gates, who memorized the license plates, look, he could see outside of his window to know when his employees would come early or late, to see their to learn their patterns. There are people like that just memorize things, that memorize train lines and schedules, and they like doing it. And there's the people that can't remember details like that at all, but they're super empathetic. They maybe know a thousand different people and connect them to each other. And they have this great social ability. In fact, maybe we had a president in the United States a few years ago who had that sort of great empathetic or social ability, but then difficulty with the details. Anyways, I won't get into
Well, and
that, but
I'm glad you sort of established these principles, not just that principle, but a few others. And you kind of said, like, look, people, we're everyone's got both of them, right? And like
yeah.
for me, I kind of think about this a lot, not just with the empathy versus the systems, but also extrovert versus introvert, these sort of concepts, right? There's these. Some psychologists will argue that, okay, well, extroversion or introversion is a trait, a genetic trait. And I just think, the difference between me as a kid and me now is I couldn't be more different, right? Yeah, maybe it's circumstance, maybe it's other things. But and then sometimes as an empathizer or a systemizer, like I feel like sometimes it can, like even when I
Well said. I know what you're getting to, that it's not fixed one way or the other. There might be
no.
a genetic relationship. Again, you're talking about systemizers, which are the engineers. I better tell everybody, the systemizers, this is a Baron Cohen's study. Systemizers are kind of more the autistic side of folks, and they're the engineers and the lawyers. And the empathizers are more on the social, emotional intelligence side of people. And they're what I call the priests and the priestesses. He did link that to genes, that sort of tendency in this huge study. But what you're saying is it's not just genetic, introversion, extroversion, being a systemizer or a empathizer. It also comes from environment. And that's really the way that biology and social human sciences are going today, there is, it's not nurture versus nature. Those two things work together all the time. Nurture plus nature is what takes us a certain direction or another. So we can change over our lifetimes.
Yeah, and so for me, I would say I lean more towards an empathizer. But as time has gone on, I realized that that's not a useful skill. I mean, it is, but as far as the balance was off, right? So I started to, again, like I told you, I wrote that I'm not a good person, but I know those who are. If I'm going to be this, if I'm going to max out my empathizer potential, I'd probably be like miserable. Like it'd be impossible. Like I have to shut that off, right? And then also part of my job, I need to be a systemizer. I need to do some things that maybe, you know, if I'm looking at my genes, right? So whatever amount of systemizer in me, I have to try to maximize, right? I have to try to like pull that out. Like, so I'll do certain things. Like if I'm gonna sit down and read or I need to write research papers, I put on a different pair of glasses. Like I'll do stuff like that. It's like, okay, it's time to switch here. I need to switch over. And I can do that to like some extent. Like I can like shut down, like in certain situations, I can shut down the empathizer part of my brain and say like, look, this is not needed here. This is going to like drain me. This is going to bring me down. And even I have to do that sometimes as a teacher, right? It's like if you switch that on all the time, you know, God bless the people that can, because I definitely can't. Like it would burn me out. It would burn me out quick. I don't know. Do you find that with yourself?
Yeah, and again, too, going back to Bill Gates, Baron Cohen talked about how he's the super systemizer, pattern seeker, always looking for patterns and things. But at the same time, he's a philanthropist. He's been giving all of his money away to fighting malaria or other kind of social, great social acts. A real humanist at the same time. So he does have that kind of effective empathy. And probably maybe that came as he grew older too. Maybe these things sort of change as we grow and learn more, as you're saying, it happened with you.
And I also, there's a part of me, and unfortunately, is a bit skeptical about philanthropists, just knowing about like the tax structure, how like you can like decide. I don't know. I shouldn't be skeptical. He might be a great person, right? But for philanthropy, I'm always a little bit skeptical because isn't that, can't you basically choose, like if you donate a certain amount of money, doesn't that offset the amount of tax you have to pay? So if you have to pay like an exorbitant amount of tax, wouldn't it make sense to say, well, I definitely want to funnel it this way? So I guess it is, you know, an empathetic thing to do, but at the same time, it's beneficial to you, right?
Yeah, I mean, look at, I don't know how much, what percentage of his wealth he's giving away, but I know it's a lot more than he's making money from, you know, or saving tax income from. I
Yeah,
think
that's
it's
true. That's true.
something like 70% of his wealth, you know, is he's devoting it to helping others. I can't better not say that figure, but yeah, it's a
Yeah, anyway, that's a side topic. All right, well, you talk about the Cohen study later. Let's back up a bit because you talked about this other paper or book, Acknowledging the Learning Styles of Diverse Student Populations, Implications for Instructional Design, Anderson and Adams, 1992. And you were talking about how minorities in the classroom, according to the study, minorities in this classroom were classified as having a more relational style, and the white students were having more of an analytical style, which I thought was kind of interesting. I kind of perked my ears up at that because I've been studying a lot about high context cultures and low context cultures. So I was kind of wondering if it's related to that idea, because like in high context cultures like Japan or Saudi Arabia, you know, building relationships is extremely important, right? In the classroom, right? So where in a low context culture, just getting the message across as simply and clearly as possible is the most important thing.
The high
So
context, Edward T. Hall's High Context, Low Context Culture could be connected to the sort of analytical relational difference between people. And by the way, you said white people, but it was really white males that Anderson and Adams were talking about as being on the analytical side.
Oh, gotcha. Sorry.
They
Yeah, that's here.
included women as being more relational in their paper. And this paper just like I read it and it turned on a light for me. Yeah, that's like a lot of the Japanese. I worked in a women's college. That's like the students I teach, whose relationships are more important than anything else. And the reason they go to school is because of their relationships. They learn better when they study in pairs. And that just really turned on a light for me. But that paper was never really got, it made a little splash at the time, but even now you can't find it on doing a search for it. You won't be able to find it except in ERIC documents or something like that that are barely readable. Nobody kind of pursued what these two people discovered
I mean, that
in
got
19.
you talked about like the hall, right? That's it really got me thinking about that, especially if the context you were teaching at a woman's university at the time, right? So like maintaining relationships is probably very, very important. A in Japan, right? High context culture. And then B at a woman's university, like I think it's really important to maintain relationships, those things that like break apart and like horrible cliques and things like that, right? So that, I mean, that's a cool topic there, just the relational style versus the analytical style. I find that like the relational style, well, like you said in the paper, it does depend on the majors, right? So I think overall there's more of this relational style in Japan. But yeah, if I teach a class full of like, architects or engineers, they're not interested in like the communicate. They're not interested in getting into groups. They're not interested in like, they just kind of want to, what do I need to do to get the grade? They'll do very well on the tests, but they're not really, it's kind of like, okay, we'll do this speaking activity. We'll do the find somebody who, we'll do this, we'll do these sort of interactional things that, but we're kind of happy to just go back and doing what we're doing in our engineering class.
Well, let's get back to what, again, Simon Baron Cohen, what he found was that he studied 660,000 people, gave them questionnaires to find out what autistic traits they have. And he actually tested some identified autistic people too to put them in the sample. And then what empathizing traits and what systemizing traits they have. Like, do you like numbers? Do you like organizing, looking how things are organized? Do you like being around a lot of people? Do you like your are your social relationships the most important thing? And you find out that a third of the population falls into the empathizers, something that we believe came out genetically about 75,000 years ago. And about a third of the people fall into the STEM systemizers, and people tend to go into STEM areas. And the empathizers are very interested in social relationships, but they don't do so well with like putting computers together, doing analytical things, technical things. And the ones that, well, I don't know how to use this computer at all. Then there's the systemizers that know everything about how to even try to program a computer, but they're not very interested in social relationships that much. And those are the kind of people that, as students, they like to study alone. They're motivated by test scores. They're good with like lists or details to memorize for a test, compared to the empathizers that are more motivated by being with other people and studying together and are not so good with the details or the patterns or the systems. So, again, we have these lawyers and priestesses in our classrooms, and we don't always identify them as being equally intelligent in different ways. And by the way, about a third of the people are kind of a mix of both. So it's a third are on the empathetic side, a third are on the autistic or systemizing side, and a third are in the middle. Then there's a little fringe at each end of the super systemizers which tend to be more like the autistics or Asperger's or that kind of area with, yeah, great people that make inventions too. Probably Bill Gates might be on that side. Then there's the super empathizers, which I think are probably the what Malcolm Gladwell wrote about is the super connectors that know everybody and can introduce people all the time. Sorry, that's a long talk, but that's what the paper was about, that we have these two types of brains and kind of a something in between they were teaching. We don't always identify it that way. And you pointed out it's connected to Hall's high context, low context culture. I pointed out it's related to what we used to think about hemispheric brains, you know, right brain, left brain. And you can look at a lot of things, theories that we have about human beings and see, you know, A type, B type personalities, and see that particular difference between systemizers and empathizers, as Baron Cohen put it.
I'm
A lot of
fascinated
other people.
with the people that are kind of in between in interesting ways. So, for example, I know a colleague who builds computers. He can build computers. It's incredible. It's amazing. He used to do it as kind of a part-time job. I think he's kind of busy now, right? And I worked with him on a research paper about 4 years ago, right? And he was constantly like forgetting where files were on his computer. Right. Like, so I would go over and it's like, okay, let's look at the data. And he said, oh man, do you have it on your computer? 'Cause I just don't. So on one way he can build a computer, right? That's a connected system that can help you make more systems, right? But you couldn't organize systems within the power of his computer that he built. I thought that was kind of a clash of in some ways. I couldn't, but I've seen that before too. Other people that seem to be like good at computers, like they can't do simple things on the computer sometimes. It's odd. There's some disconnect there. I don't know
Yeah,
what it
that's
is
interesting.
exactly.
That's very interesting. So there's a lot more for us to discover, for sure.
Oh, and like
Yeah,
the
that's
whole idea,
fantastic.
you know, the story of, you know, of like Mozart or Beethoven, you know, the idea like their living space was a complete mess, right? Or there was a documentary with Glenn Gould, the pianist, and they went into like his cabin where he would practice, and there was just files of manuscripts everywhere, right? But when the interviewer asked him a question, he said, "Oh yeah, oh that sonata, yeah, it's like over there behind the bench underneath the hammer." So he actually knew. So then the one thing is the argument where like if you're at a certain amount of intelligence, you don't need this really organized system. Maybe like the gates, right? I guess he had made a system in his own mind. It doesn't make sense to us. Like it looked like a total mess, but he knew where every piece of paper was in his cluttered, finger quotes, living space. I don't know if I don't know if Beethoven did. I don't know if people have talked about that. But then like for me, I need things to be really, really clean so I can like get to them quickly. Because I don't want to think about where I put them. So maybe that's why I'm dedicating myself to make a clear system for more efficiency. Again, which maybe is the argument that, oh, maybe because I'm more of an empathizer, I need to invest more time in like making systems that are like faster. I don't know. It's an interesting topic.
You're asking a lot of good questions, thank you. But yeah, looking back at musicians like Beethoven and Wagner were known for just being terrible to other people. Their social skills were just terrible. But you could tell by the kind of music, you know, like Bach too, and by the kind of music that they make, that they're really good with patterns and complicated engineering of sound to make this thing that really moves us. So there's probably somebody that's more on the STEM side, the autistic systemizer pattern seeker side.
Well, then, what do you do when you have a class, a mixed major class, right? So, for my schedule, I have a class of like all art students, right? So, for the most part, I'm going to categorize them as like empathizers, right? And I can base my class around that. And then for I have a class of all engineers. They're mostly systemizers. I can organize my class for that. But then the dreaded mixed major class, where you have people from all over the school, right, all coming together. What advice would you have for teachers with that situation?
I think it's pretty easy because I had a class like that, 90 students in business, and some you could tell were just super social. So we did pair work every class to solve this mystery together with their peers. But at the same time, I had all the scores for the class coming from kind of traditional study of reading and quizzes and things like that at the beginning of class. So the analyticals had something they could excel at. And the relationals had something that they could enjoy. And they both had to do both. So it also sort of trained them a little bit in the area they were weak at. You know what I mean? If it was all relational, then the analyticals would probably fail and hate the class. But they had their analytical part too. If it was all analytical, then the relationals would be kind of bored or whatever. So I had a little bit of both so that everybody could excel. And everybody could expand themselves in their weaker area, theoretically at least. And it seemed to work really well.
What do you think about this? If someone has a particular skill or tendency or inclination, do you think it's more important to try to max out that inclination, or do you think it's more important to work doubly hard on the other side to
Oh,
make
man.
yourself a more balanced person?
You're asking one of the toughest questions in education. Exactly that. Should we teach towards somebody's strengths or towards their weaknesses? And I think it's both. I think you have to teach to their strengths so they feel good about themselves and enjoy it. But you also have to help them with their weaknesses and letting them know that this is what you're not good at. So we're going to work a little bit extra hard on this. I guess that's just a. I don't have any evidence to support that, just that's kind of the way I speculate it works. What do you think?
Well, so before I got into language teaching, I was studying to be a musician. And it was really, really tough, right? And at a certain point, it became so tough, I quit just because the amount of time I just spent practicing, and I think the effort reward imbalance was just off, right? And then I could envision myself as a professional trumpet player, but then I thought my life would not be that happy. Maybe the highs would be the higher than a normal life's highs, right? But the lows would be definitely lower than a normal life's lows. But during that time when I was like really studying to be a trumpet player and like not having a lot of money and like feeling kind of in that world, in an isolated world, I remember, I think it was one of my college professors said, "You know what? This whole system is screwed up, right? Like why are these music majors, these performance majors studying music all the time? Half the curriculum should be to train them to be like to work on air conditioners, to be an electrician, to be a painter, so that they have a part-time job that they can do while they're trying to get their job, right?" And that really like struck me. I was like, you know what? You're right. Like what? Like yeah, maybe some people are like going all in, right? And it's like yeah, there's no backup plan. Like going all in. Like why think of something else? I'm just going to do this. But I thought that kind of made sense. So it's like if you're a skilled electrician, you could always get a job. If you're a skilled plumber, you can always get a job. Like, why aren't we learning that? Like, we don't need to take all of these music classes, right? We're already kind of talented in music. Shouldn't we be doing something else? I don't know. I don't know if that answered your question, but.
Well, I think you just hit on another really good point that we have to teach people to do things that'll help their lives. I see the purpose of education is to give people better lives. And that involves lots of things, a lot of things that we're not teaching, like how to manage romantic relationships, how to raise kids, how to find part-time jobs that'll support your passion when you want to do your passion, as you just said. Or in education, what I loved about my doctoral program was we didn't just study education, you know, especially theoretical education. We had to study things like trend analysis, program evaluation, program development, other things, human relations, HR, other things that became really important for us if we became administrators in a school because we had doctorates or whatnot, governance. These were the core courses, not, educational theoretical courses. And I think the more practical courses helped me in my career more than the sort of research content oriented courses. Anyway, so yeah, we have to teach people how to live their lives, how to become happy in life, how to live well. So yeah, I agree with what you were talking about as a musician. Too
Yeah,
narrow,
and that's
maybe.
I struggle with that too, because I remember in my job interview for the position I have now, they're like, "What's your core teaching philosophy?" And I probably stole this from somebody else. I'm sure he did, because it's similar to what you just said. It's like, provide people with tools to make them to help them. I'm butchering this, but like, provide people with tools to help themselves make a better life for themselves. Like, that's the
Yeah,
goal of
yeah.
a teacher, right? But then I struggle with that, even my own idea of what a teacher should be, because oftentimes, like the students I have, all they don't foresee any future with English, a lot of these students I have. So it's like, on one side I'm saying, well, I want to help you have a better life by help giving you these skills for English. Like, you can, here are specific ways by using this skill it can make your life better, right? But at the same time, they don't see it that way, right? So then I'm
Yeah,
like,
that's
well,
not.
am I like forcing my opinion on what can make your life better on you? Like, that's not good.
Yeah, that's a, you asked all you're asking all the difficult questions in education. Wow.
Well, I think that's why I like doing these
Yeah,
interviews in these
I'll
months when
be
I'm kind of
eyeing
reading a lot and
away
stuff.
with all these things that you said.
But quickly, I want, before I forget, you get a little bit of a tidbit in this article, which I wanted to like ask you about. You said there was like, the relate you were talking about the relational type of learners wh who might skip a class if their friends skipped a class, right?
Yeah, I
And
saw that a
yeah,
lot of universities.
but then you mentioned that your wife was one of those people.
Oh dear, yeah.
So what's that story?
I remember once, you're going to go to class today? No, Akiko's not going, so I'm not going to go either. And I thought, wow, what a weird thing for her to say that she's not going to go take a this graduate class because her friend's not going. That was her motivation to go to school, to be with the people that she was really close to.
Wow. So you're married to a relational learner.
I guess so. I'm not really sure. Maybe
That
was just them.
so if you're both invited to a party and you don't go, she's not going to go?
Boy, that's a tough question. Other thing. She likes to she's not highly relational. I won't say that. She's relational with her friends and family, certain people. But she's not the kind of person who wants to make new friends right away.
So she's a loyal relationalist. I just made up that word. Let's make it
Yeah,
stick.
there you go. That's a good one. Yeah.
Hey, can we talk? Maybe we can wrap it up. Can we talk a little bit about your life in Portland?
Yeah, just
So, what do you say is like the biggest difference between living in Portland and living in Osaka?
the two are, as I said before, driving everywhere. That's I've become my main purpose has just been to drive people places. That's the main thing I do every day. Then the other difference is in Japan, I was in this community of teachers and researchers with interesting ideas. I get invited to do presentations here and there, and It was really rich that way, but here, not at all. I belong to ORTESOL. I'm a member of the board and helped them set up a conference last fall, but I'm not involved in teaching and I don't have much contact with teachers. So this really kind of important part of my life was taken away.
Yeah,
And even my
that seems like it
just
would be a bit dramatic.
when I was in Japan, I was much more kakkoi because I was involved in so many things and, doing work and whatnot. Now I'm just this guy sitting behind a computer in his, t-shirt.
Well, is there an opportunity to, or do you have a desire to get back into the classroom in some capacity?
If I can teach something about, if I can teach brain science, yes. But I just don't see that opportunity because, again, I'm so busy. In addition to driving, I'm doing about half the cooking, washing clothes, of course, doing the think tanks. So I don't really have a whole lot of free time.
So you're still heavily involved in the think tanks. Are you still in charge of that? Oh, okay, great. Well, that's cool. That's cool.
And I'd like to say too that right now, Stephen M. Ryan and I are making a ITDI online course about
Nice.
the neuroscience of language teaching, of language learning. It'll be a
Cool.
like art course that we're going to probably launch next September. It'll talk about things like this that we talked about today. Or about how, why the brain likes stories so well, or how the brain does language. Not many people really know how we do language, or how the brain is always metaphorical. It's connecting things that it knows to new things, and that's how we learn. And
Now,
just
is this connected to the in one of your email correspondences? You were talking about some videos that you were making. Is this related to this class?
yes,
Oh, I see.
each.
Okay.
About five or six short videos on different topic on topics related to whatever that course that module is, like how the brain does language. I just recorded four videos for that last week.
Oh wow, cool. With Stephen, what's it, what's the middle initial?
Stephen M. Ryan. There's two Stephen Ryans in Japan. There's the one at Waseda that's in the it's a psychologist.
Right.
There's Stephen M. Ryan at Sanyo in Okayama. A great guy, good friend. He was president of a university for a while in Japan. And he's really the other person who's working on the think tanks. They were working on this course together too.
Yeah,
I
as a
call him
fun.
M. AM because there's two Stephen Ryan, so he's Stephen M. Ryan, so I call him M.
That's a funny story because I ended up interviewing Stephen Ryan, the one from Waseda, who co-authored a book with Dornier, and I wrote this long email, and I had actually emailed Stephen M. Ryan, and Stephen M. Ryan wrote me back and said, "I appreciate the email, but I think you're looking for the famous guy in Waseda." And
Well, have
then,
you interviewed Ryan?
no, I should. But then I interviewed Stephen Ryan, and Stephen Ryan said that he knew Stephen M. Ryan. And not only that, he said that Stephen Ryan from Waseda and Stephen M. Ryan both know another Stephen Ryan, and they have
Oh
and they're
no.
thinking about starting the Stephen Ryan SIG.
Stephen Ryan's like, there you go. We're in trouble. But you should interview Stephen Emery. He's a great talker. His specialties are study abroad. I think he's got papers on that. He's really into predictive processing in the brain. He can explain it much better than I can. So yeah, he's another guy to talk to.
And one recommendation to you and the other members of the MindBred Education SIG, if you haven't listened, check out episode 135 of this podcast, where I interviewed Dr. Jared Cooney Horvath. And he wrote a book that's called Stop Talking, Start Influencing, 12 Insights from Brain Science to Make Your Message Stick. And he talked a lot about stories. And I think people would get it. Would like it because his whole philosophy is again taking concepts from neuroscience and making it applicable in the classroom. So it's kind of like
Yes.
if you like this kind of way of thinking or talking, he's totally in that vein as well. So
Thank you. Thanks for that. I'll see if I can get him to write for us.
he's and he also did this video series as well, where he talked about a lot of these concepts about the brain and how people learn. So yeah, if people haven't, especially people in the mind brain education scene, if they haven't heard that, they may like it. He's a nice guy, American.
Thank you. I'll pass it on within the next 24 hours.
Yeah. Well, anything else you want to talk about in the paper today? Or I feel like we hit a lot of big topics and made people even more confused, or at least I did. Well, not confused, maybe open their minds more to more questions, right?
No, I just think we've always had this sort of understanding that there's the nerds and the snowflakes, this selfie peoples. But now we know why. We know there's a genetic connection and a personality connection. And it's not just weirdness because there is no normal. It's just part of the great neurodiversity that we're starting to appreciate.
I got one more question for you before we wrap this up.
Okay.
So after we record, I'm going to meet with a colleague of mine who is kind of struggling to get some research going. And we all, I think we all go through this at some point in our career if we stay in the business, right? I have my own ideas. I'm not going to share them here, but if you were going to sit down with someone who comes to you and says, "Yeah, man, I just can't get it going." Like, what advice would you give to someone to try to just get something started as far as a research project and thinking about ways to even get started with a topic or?
It's the same kind of problem that I have, but I think two things. The experts say, start with something little. Like, don't start and say, I got to do this research project today. Think of something like, well, I'm going to just write one paragraph today. And once you get started with a little thing, you tend up not being able to stop. The other thing is, give yourself lots of time to kind of think through it. Times something I don't really want to do because my brain hasn't really settled on what to do yet. And sometimes it comes to me in the middle of the night, ah, that's what I need, that's the answer. You're energized to do something. Could I step out for a minute here?
Well, we can end it there. At least I'll stop the recording. Dr. Curtis Kelly, thank you so much for coming on Lost in Citations.
Thank you. It's great talking to you, Jonathan. Let's do it again.
If you'd like to contact the show, the best place to find out about us is our website, lostincitations.com. Here you can learn more about the background to this project and how you can get involved. Our hope is to help academics, educators, and online content producers get in contact with each other. Our email address is lostincitations@gmail.com. We also have Facebook and LinkedIn pages. Please rate and comment on the sites you use to download your podcasts. It helps us reach more potential listeners. But probably the most helpful thing you can do is, if you like our content, recommend it to a friend and let them know what we're trying to do. Thank you very much.